Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Friday, April the 5th, 2024. Another week in tech. Hasn't been a good week for my own particular football team. They drew 1-1 at West Ham United in East London. Of course, West Ham famous for their bubbles. But the bubble wasn't a bubble for Tottenham, at least when they went there this week. And a bubble isn't a bubble for Keith either. Keith Tier, the author of That Was the Week, his newsletter. I don't think he was watching the Spurs game. He's probably watching something else. But the title of his newsletter this week is When is a Bubble Not a Bubble? And Keith is joining us not from East London, but from Palo Alto, just down the peninsula from me. Keith, when is a bubble not a bubble?
Well, a bubble is not a bubble when you disagree with the people who say it is. Let's put it that way. A bubble is in the eye of the beholder, shall we say. What I talk about in my editorial this week is that bubble has become a politicized word. That is to say, for people who are pretty much skeptics on technology and innovation, whenever money is attracted to something new in Silicon Valley, the word bubble arises pretty much in the first day, definitely by the first week, and it lasts for several years until inevitably there's some correction in the market and then the bubble has burst. And that narrative is basically a false narrative.
And I bet it is Lina Khan behind the bubble.
Lina Khan has nothing to do with the bubble. New listeners will not get the joke, but we talk about Lina Khan
a lot. He has a particular love-hate relationship, more hate with Lina Khan than love. So even though you, Keith, you've acknowledged that, I mean, even if you're not a tech skeptic, sometimes the bubble is for real. I mean, there is some general frothiness about the AI economy, isn't there? Would you acknowledge that?
Well, I think if you put it into normal language and say that large amounts of money are being attracted very early to a promising future technology, and that the money being attracted is a lot larger than would be justified by the current value of these things, then yes, that would be true. But that, to me, is normal and rational behavior. It's people betting on the outcome earlier than the outcome is, for certain. And I think in technology, that almost always benefits the people making the bets. So bubble implies they're doing something irrational. I don't think they are. I think they're being super rational.
Well, I'm going to cheat a little bit. Usually we end on the X of the week, but let's begin there because your X of the week is an anti-bubble post by Mike Maples, who was at the Y Combinator event this week with Gary Tan and the Y Combinator team. And Maples was really blown away with all the AI there. So maybe talk about that. Were you there, Keith? It looks as if there was a lot of interesting stuff going on. There was this car outside that I actually saw in San Francisco. I don't know who makes this car, but it's visually astonishing. When I saw it, I almost crashed my own car. And then, of course, there's the obligatory dog-like robots and lots of sunlit rooms where excited entrepreneurs sat and contributed to the bubble. What happened at the Y Combinator event that so impressed Mike Maple?
Well, firstly, standard practice is that something like 250 companies are chosen by Y Combinator to go through a training experience where they improve, you know, their story and often their business over about a 3-month period. And they have a demo day at the end of it. So last week was the demo day. Of the 264, a very large number were AI companies. That is a Tesla car, by the way, just in case your not
is it, but is it a test that you can buy or is it a prototype?
No, you can buy it. It's that's the finished look. It's meant to compete with the Ford F-150.
Well, anyway, that was there, and there were all the robots. I mean, that robot looks as if it could have existed 10 years ago. I don't know what was so revolutionary about that one.
Probably mechanically it could have, but I bet you the software makes it do things it couldn't have done 10 years ago now. I mean, but anyway, the short story is Maple was impressed by the quality of the founders and their focus. And Mike is a principal at Floodgate Ventures. He makes investments, early stage investments.
Yeah, and he wrote, "I could sense greatness in every direction that I look." So Mike Maple certainly doesn't believe in the bubble, although the VCs wouldn't, would they?
Well, they don't. You see, a bubble is good. That's what people don't understand. A bubble is good. It means that money is being attracted to innovation. Imagine if there was no bubble. It would imply that there's no opportunity.
Yeah, and that's the analysis of a lot of tech historians. Carlota Perez, I think, suggests that bubbles are essential in order to create the infrastructure for real innovation. So what happened in AI this week, Keith, in terms of making sense of what one of your pieces was called by Ed Zitron was called bubble trouble?
Yeah, well, he's focused on a technicality. It's interesting he used the word bubble trouble, but I think his real message is AI may be in trouble, and his argument is that lack of data to train the AI on, meaning that at some point 100% of all the available data to train on will have been used, and at that point, how will the AI get cleverer?
Which is a good point. And of course, you didn't cite some of these pieces, but there's ongoing issues in the law courts between creatives and these new AI platforms about whether they should or shouldn't have the right to their creativity, to their art, to their music, to their writing. So the content or the stuff that Zitron's so worried about may dry up even before they've come to the end of it.
I don't think there's a concept of it drying up. I actually think he's making a mistake. AI doesn't work like that. It doesn't need an endless stream of new data. It needs to have enough data to become clever. And once it becomes clever, it can parse data that it's never seen before. For example, I put code into ChatGPT that it's never seen before, but it's clever enough based on its learning to be able to edit my code and make it better. So I don't think AI requires an unlimited amount of data.
You're an unrestrained optimist, Keith. There's nothing about this AI craze that worries you at all? I didn't call it a bubble.
I would say all science contains the limits of its current knowledge. So, you know, if you look at the history of medical science, of air travel, at any given moment, the science contains within itself the limits of the science.
Yeah, but that wasn't the question. I mean, last week the
answer is, of course, everyone should be worried, but the answer to being worried is more science, not less science.
What about the, neither you or I are scientists, we're more interested in the market and startup opportunities. Last week we had the story of Mustafa Suleiman and Reid Hoffman's startup that essentially they gave away to Microsoft. Clearly they couldn't raise the money. You mentioned, I don't know if it's you or perhaps one of the pieces, that the only real manifestation of bubble investment was Amazon's $4 billion investment in, Anthropic. So, I mean, in the actual marketplace, is there a bubble? Are people bidding irrationally, what one famous economist would call irrational exuberance, that I think he coined in the late 90s to define the dot-com insanity, which was a bubble, whatever you say.
Well, a bubble is only a bubble at the end. Up until the end.
What's it before? A little bubble. No. What about a big bubble?
Before, it's... and by the way, it's always rational in my view. There is no such thing as irrational exuberance, except for the people who come too late and overpay just before prices are reset. And if you understand, you know, how long cycles work, this is a repetitive...
Let's use the late 90s as an example. One of your companies experienced the bubble phase, certainly more than one of mine. In the late 90s, there were many companies, the vast majority didn't survive. So is that the case? So let me just, because this is an important question in terms of this AI economy. Of the 100 AI startups, how many of them will, in your view, still be around in 5 years?
It'll be shocking if the answer is more than 10%.
So you're a bubble guy, Keith.
No, I think that's entirely rational, because the 10% that survive will make a lot more than 100% of the money invested.
But that's not that wasn't the question I asked. So let's go back to the 90s. If we were talking in 1997, 1998, it may only be 1 in 100 that would have survived in 2001. Are we not going to have what economists would call the correction in the AI economy?
Yeah, but you see, the narrative is being framed as a pejorative, as if there's something wrong. The truth is, massive amounts of value are being created. It's not destroyed. Value isn't being destroyed. It's being created. And a bubble, a bubble implies the opposite. So bubble... Let me finish as well. A bubble is an ignorant word spoken by someone that doesn't understand economics.
I'm not sure that's true. Let's go back to the 90s. There were a lot of Me Too dog food online stores, and none of them survived. Maybe one of them survived.
That was a bubble in dot-com. You're kind of making things up, Andrew. There was one of those.
There's only one everyone can remember. Was it called dogfood.com?
Yeah, but there was lots that made it. Like I use, I'm blanking on its name now, but I get food for my dog from the pet place that was started way back, and it's massive and profitable, just like the shoe.
You're misreading what the bubble people would say. They're not claiming any moral observation. They're simply saying that of the 10 companies in of the 100 companies in AI today, only 5 or 10 of them are going to survive. Most of them will go away, and there'll be a climax or an anticlimax where the money runs out, and that's always the case. But there's no moral observation here.
No,
reality.
The implication, Andrew, is that things are being overpriced. Now, if you want to really mathematically determine whether things are being overpriced, you have to measure the price from the amount of value that will be produced from the investments. And the amount of value that will be produced from these investments is, you know, many, many, many times more than the investments. So even if 90% of these companies fail, it isn't a bubble from the point of view of the people writing the checks. It's an investment. And it's a good investment, probably.
I knew there was some signal rank ideology here. You're just trying to get people to invest in startups. I think we both know the truth about this.
Well, any individual startup, Andrew, is a risk. So if you were to ask me, you know, is that investment in that company indicative of a bubble? I might say yes. But good investors don't only invest in one company. Venture capital
is... Right, but I think the point of bubbles is that you're right, of course, about good investors people like Mike Maple, who probably see these the best deals before everyone else. But the point about bubbles is it brings everyone in. So it's not just the good investors, it's the bad investors. That's the old story of the cab driver. Everybody in the late 90s knew that it was, whether you want to call it a bubble or a craze or irrational exuberance, when cab drivers in New York or San Francisco started to talk to you about the value of Yahoo stock. Bubble, whatever you want to call it, exuberance or excitement, it attracts less professional investors. There's more money, there's more froth, and there are more casualties, startup casualties, investor casualties.
If you look at the venture capital section of this week's newsletter, you would conclude that the opposite is happening, that there's a shrinking amount of money going into venture capital. The large numbers in AI are almost entirely driven by Amazon's investment. So, So actually, individual investors are not piling in. And venture capital as a whole has got less money than it's had for many years. All the graphs are down in terms of amount raised and number of rounds. The average per round is flat to up at the early stage, but down at the late stage.
Right. And this comes in, we've talked about this before, and you had another interesting piece from TechCrunch about big tech companies forming a new consortium to allay fears of AI job takeovers. One of the things I've observed, you haven't pushed back on this one, I think, is that it's much less of a kind of crazy startup environment in the mid 2020s than it was in the mid 1990s, because you can't just start a company with a credit card and a couple of guys. Now you may not need the kind of billions of dollars that Anthropic require, but you still got to have significant resources. So it lends itself less to startups. And oddly enough, it's the big tech companies, the Googles, the Microsofts, the Amazons, and the Apples of the world that are both big tech companies and also doing the starting up. Is that right?
It's right, but there's an equally impressive counter trend. The counter trend is that because of AI, it's now possible for individuals to create companies without software or hardware. And one of the memes in the Valley is that in the next decade, we're going to see the first billion-dollar companies that have a single employee, the founder. And actually, Rex Woodbury's piece this week about
weapons of mass
production. Kind of relate to that.
But what would that mean? I mean, how can you have a company without hardware or software? Is it just basically Tim Ferriss or?
No, because you use AI to build software, so you don't need engineers. And the software is hosted in the cloud almost for free. Like my bill at Snowflake for the whole of SignalRank is about $1,000 a month. It's not very much in the big picture. So the counter trend is that productivity, which is really the theme of this week's editorial due to the Economist article about China, productivity is going to get to the point where a single individual could do what used to take a team of 300.
Yeah. And that of course, raises the issue, Keith, as you know better than I do, about jobs. The weapons of mass production touches on that. And there's another piece that I think you're going to add to the newsletter, which is interesting. David Autor is a very distinguished economist at MIT, always been very critical of the impact of AI on jobs. But he's actually, and this is a piece from the New York Times this week, he's changed his mind. He thinks that AI might benefit the middle class because it will undermine the kind of monopoly of professional classes, of the engineers and the doctors and the lawyers. So he, whereas most people are rather pessimistic, Autor is actually becoming more optimistic, which I assume you share his position.
Yeah.
And it would fit with the weapons of mass production, where we all become entrepreneurial titans.
Yeah, I'd count myself as one of the middle class that he is referring to, because I use AI for coding. One of our listeners, by the way, just put in the chat that they've shipped 3 SaaS products in the last period in 6 months themselves as an individual. And I'm one of those. Tom Landers also says there's a book called Ask You Developer. Is that right? It doesn't seem right. How a single person might create a unicorn. So there is a whole discussion around this, and that's because it's quite credible. It's real. I'm one of them. In the last 3 weeks, I've completely rewritten SignalRank's algorithms to a new upgraded algorithm that performs even better than the old one. And I did it all by myself. I'm a B-level SQL engineer. And, you know, my team see me doing it, and I'm a single-handedly building an entire ecosystem.
What do you need a team for? I mean, that might reverse the argument. What happens to the coders you used to employ?
They work on deep science mostly, that is lower down in the stack. I built a website, SignalRank.ai, using it. It honestly, you can do a lot. And I know with Keen On and Now TV, Andrew, you're always looking for help. You're going to be able to do it yourself, I guarantee.
Well, I already do, which is why it's such a bad show. it's definitely, we're going to have many, many conversations about this. But I was particularly intrigued by the author piece because, as I said, I mean, he's a very credible economist, and he seems to think that it actually might benefit the middle class. Although, on the other hand, what I would be fearful of in this new world, in this weapons of mass production, where you can have companies without hardware and software, is it would compound the winner-take-all economics of the last 25 years. But that's another question. I know that, Keith, your thinking on bubbles was actually triggered this week by a piece on China by Simon Cox, the economist, China economics editor, called Money Talks. What is Cox saying, and what does this have to do with bubbles?
So Cox has been covering China a long time, and he starts by quoting himself from 2006, saying that China's mission as a nation is to combine technology to recreate, in quotes, the productive forces, and make it possible for productivity to be very, very high. And then he goes on in an article that he wrote for the printed magazine this week to talk about how that is the core of Xi's beliefs, which, by the way, is the opposite of the Cultural Revolution, when modernity was frowned upon and tried to be destroyed. So China now is pro-tech, pro-innovation. Productive forces is a Marxist word that combines human beings and technology into a single thing. And its focus is to develop the division of labor so that less people can do more of what more people used to do before. So Cox is picking that up, and it triggered in me a recognition that pure message of innovation really last existed in Western culture, in the Enlightenment, when positivism was the big buzzword. And that today, actually, the Western nations are super skeptical of technology and don't have that sense of progress that China is talking about. And it feels to me as if that's going to be a huge impediment to modernizing America, the UK, most of Europe. And they will get left behind, not because they're incapable, but because they've intellectually persuaded themselves to not like technology.
Yeah, I don't know who you've been talking to, but I mean, there is currently a little bit of pessimism about technology, but I don't see that in America. There's still a lot of massive faith in the potential of technology, of green tech, of digital technology. AI. I mean, who are you talking to, Keith? Where is all this pessimism?
Actually, I did say that Silicon Valley is the only part of the US that's like China. Silicon Valley does believe in those.
Where else have you been? What isn't like China? What about New York's full of innovation?
come on, look at the Baltimore Bridge discussion. They claim it's going to take them more than 10 years to rebuild that bridge. That's not very innovative.
Well, that's an infrastructure problem, but that doesn't reflect technological pessimism.
It reflects societal pessimism that also infects technology. You know, teenagers' mental health crisis is the other one. Everybody's focused on problematizing rather
than... Some people might be listening to this, Keith, and thinking, what about this obnoxious Yorkshireman? Why doesn't he just go and live in China if you love it so much? Go and live in...
No, I'm living in the part of America that is the most like China, which is Silicon Valley.
Well, we will see. I have to admit, I don't agree. I think America still is much more innovative than China culturally and in many other senses. One area where there is, and I agree with you here, a great deal of pessimism is on social media. Jonathan Haidt has been very influential in this. He has a new book out, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. I don't know if you've had a chance to read the book, Keith, but what do you think of Haidt's thesis about this connection between anxiety, mental health, and social media?
You know, I'm not an expert, but I'm going to tell you my intuition is to completely disagree with it. I think mental health is, back in our day, Andrew, when we were at university, we used to call it alienation. That is to say, a lack of a sense of purpose and belonging. And I think the causes of that, and I do think it's real, but I think the causes of that are to do with the real prospects in society. The fact that, you know, my children, the idea they could buy a house is a pipe dream. So the real truth is that anxiety and alienation or a low sense of opportunity is driven by the real world. If anything, social media is a place people go to get away from that, to live in a slightly unreal world where their friends are and they can enjoy themselves. Probably that explains why TikTok's so popular. It's fun. So I think of social media as the same as I think about going to the movies or a concert. It's a place to escape to for young people, and not a place to where they learn to be mentally ill.
So you're saying that the anxiety, which is a fact, I don't think anyone would disagree with that, the high rates of therapy and mental illness, especially amongst younger people, that's a reflection of what, late stage digital capitalism or whatever you want to call it, or the nature of our economy?
It's probably too early to fully diagnose it, but I'd be shocked if COVID didn't have something to do with it. The fact, one of my sons spent 2 years working from home instead of being in college. He was lucky he got a job because I could make some introductions, but none of his friends have gotten jobs and they have the same degrees as him. I think it's actually a realistic reaction to what's happening.
Another interesting piece that you had this week, and a lot of really, it's a great newsletter, Keith, is from one of your favorite writers, Thomas Tongus, a venture capitalist, we've talked endlessly about the attention economy on this show, and books have been written about it, but the increasing decline of attention. Do you think, and I don't know what Tongus thinks about this, is there a connection between this anxious generation and their inability to pay attention? Does an inability to pay attention create more or less anxiety, and where's the causality here? Is the lack of attention causing anxiety, or is the anxiety causing the lack of attention?
Well, based on my prior answer, I'm going to say neither. What's happening is attention is now a currency, and you're not going to give your attention to something unless it adds something. And people now have an ability to parse information super fast and decide whether to give it more time. I just watched The Three Body Problem on Netflix, and I didn't read the novel it's four novels, actually. I didn't read any of them before. Now I will, because the attention I gave to the show made me realize that I want to read the novels. And sometimes I'll see a tweet and I'll click on it and disappear immediately from the page I go to. Other times I'll spend 30 minutes there. So I think what people are doing is they're being able to pass and reject much faster. They're highly educated to do that. And so I think most of these things are symptoms of intelligence, not of failure. Now, I do think that deep diving into subject areas that our LinkedIn user here just talked about is super important. I spend hours every day deep diving into my work, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on a website that doesn't add anything to me. I'm going to pay it less attention. And given that we're using Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn, where it's posts, not essays mostly, I think the ability to leave quickly is a skill everyone has to learn. So I think that reduction in attention span is people deciding to leave quickly.
So you're not in the cultural pessimist community who argue that, and this debate again has been going on for almost 20 years. Nick Carr was very influential. Our failure of the attention economy undermining our ability to write books. You think it reflects more intelligence rather than less? You're in a minority there, Keith, but maybe you're right.
Well, look, are you being intelligent when you leave a website quickly because there's nothing there for you?
But that's nothing to do with the attention economy. I mean, there's always, you could read a book and you put it down after a couple of pages because you didn't like it or you found it boring. That's got nothing to do with the attention economy. You'd pick up another book.
In Thomas's case, I'm going to guess it's a sign of lack of product market fit between his content and the people who show up to the website.
Yeah, I think anyone who actually goes to websites these days is archaic. They're probably old, Keith, like you and I, and you had an interesting piece on age. The world is getting older. Global senior population is growing dramatically. Interesting piece on this. How does this fit into the narrative about anxiety and attention and the bubble of AI? Is it connected or is it a separate theme here?
Well, there's a lot of complicated things buried inside it. An aging population is usually considered a bad thing because the question then arises, who will do the work? But in the era we're living in, there's another question, which is, will there be any work? Those two questions kind of coexist. We also have this immigration debate about how too many people are coming into the country, but at the same time, there isn't enough people to do the jobs, as came out today in the numbers, by the way. The jobs numbers were super high again. So I put this in because I've long believed that, I'm not a Malthusian, so I don't believe that...
Well, explain, but not everyone, Keith, will know what a Malthusian is.
Well, I don't believe that population size is the main variable in calculating resource allocation. I think productivity is. And so what that means is that a shrinking working population is fine as long as productivity is going up. The earlier conversation implies that that is likely to happen, but I still think the jury should be out on that. Tech hasn't always delivered productivity increases. In fact, rarely it does it. So I think the jury's out, but I do think you've got to put population aging, immigration, the decline of jobs, all have to be in the same conversation, which really requires a national vision for the future. And the interesting thing is that's what China, whether you like China or not, and there's obviously a lot wrong with China, but the one thing you can't deny is they have a national narrative on the future. The parody of that is the five-year plan that Stalin invented. But having some kind of a plan is probably a good idea. And I don't think there is one in America. I think all these conversations are politicized short term, And no one really owns the narrative for the near or.
You know what? It's also good about China, Keith.
Yeah.
Lena Khan isn't there.
It's true. That's true. They're worse than her.
Are you? If you get a call from the Chinese ambassador after this, you're going to accept their passport, give up living in Palo Alto, and go and live in Beijing?
I will not be doing that because I love living in America. My critique of America is because I want to live here and I would like it.
Yeah, and what's interesting in all seriousness about this growth of old people is we already have. We've got an election coming up in America, as everybody knows, between two seemingly senile 80-year-olds. What is this global senior population going to do to the current gerontocracy in America? Is it going to make it even more gerontocratic? What happens to young people?
It will. And by the way, it also implies, by the way, Andrew, that young people are not having families at the same rate that earlier generations did.
Comes back to the anxiety and the friends of your son who can't get work. Most people don't get married and don't have kids if they don't have work.
Exactly. So that to me is kind of structural and requires, you know, that bridge in Baltimore should be back up and running in 12 months.
Well, maybe Biden should call you up and you can run it. What about in terms of the size of this older generation? What about resources themselves? Our generation, Keith, you and I are good examples of this. We own expensive real estate, which presumably we will only give up when we die. If we continue to live, how does wealth get redistributed within communities?
You know, I think that ends up being very personal. I can tell you in my case, there's no way I can live in my house until I die unless I come into a large sum of money, because most of my net worth is in property. And I think that's true of most people, by the way, that own property. It's a big part of their net worth. And so you end up having to sell and move somewhere cheaper and live off the proceeds.
In China, Keith. How's the real estate in China?
It's actually correcting right now to lower prices.
Wow. Well, it's all coming into place. Finally, we're going to come to our startup of the week. There was one interesting piece that you put in about John Stewart plunging the knife into Apple. What's John Stewart been doing? He's always been a big fan of tech. Is his pessimism now about tech, does that reflect a broader pessimism about tech in America?
I don't really know what he really thinks about tech, but he interviewed Lena Khan this week, which was apparently Apple wouldn't let him interview her. So Apple has the same taste as me, it seems. So he left and he brought her onto The Daily Show to interview her. And I do suspect he is part of the generation that looks at social media. I mean, he has a self-interest, right? He's an old media success story, and he has not been a new media success story. So for him, social media is probably a competitor, if you will. Although I do note that he's been putting his Daily Show monologues on YouTube recently, and I for one have been watching them. So maybe he's learning. Anyway, he stuck the knife into Apple by outing them for limiting his editorial capabilities on the show that Apple was paying for.
I mean, it sounds like the same fight that between your friend and I don't want to have an Elon Musk conversation. He's fortunately not in the newsletter this week. Elon Musk and Don Lemon.
Yep.
I mean, the people who pay for these shows have every right to cancel it if they don't want it, whether it's Musk, X, or Apple, don't they?
They have the right, but you can draw your own conclusions about their custodial power is being wielded to prevent conversation that they don't approve of. Normally, a libertarian would say that's not okay.
Well, I think we should be honest, Keith, and acknowledge that this show is brought to you by the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese government. Exactly. And they're paying us large amounts of money for Keith to trash America and suggest that we should all go and live in Beijing, which I am not going to do. But I think maybe, Keith, next show, you'll be in Beijing, I'll be in
maybe Shanghai, Andrew. Or
Shanghai. Well, that all sounds the same to me. Anyway, finally, Keith, We've done X of the week. That was Mike Maple and his excitement. We're not calling it a bubble over AI, but it's an interesting startup of the week. I never heard of it. Not this one. It's called Rubrik, and it's not Rubrik's Cube. It's the Rubrik IPO. Tell us why you've given this award, your startup of the week award, to Rubrik. What's significant about it?
It's because it's the second IPO in recent weeks. The other one was Reddit. Reddit, by the way, is shocking to me. Its share price has gone quite up since it IPO'd. Rubrik is a more standard enterprise company in the security space, and it's
far incredibly boring. But clearly, yeah. You're seeing it as symbolic. You're less interested in its IPA and more what it tells us about the economy.
Yeah, and about IPOs in general, and the optimism in Silicon Valley will go quite a lot further up if that IPO is successful. And I think it will be, from what I read about it.
So there's reasons to be cheerful, Keith, even in America, even if it can't be China, still the IPO market is back, and we should be cheerful in the spring of 2024.
Always look on the bright side of life is the song, isn't it?
Even for Spurs fans?
Even for Spurs fans, because it could be a lot worse.